Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. While the military conflict in Ukraine is far from over, the political fate of this country will be determined at the ballot box over the next few days. Regions of Ukraine are set to reject Kiev's rule and join the Russian Federation. Once part of Russia, Moscow will defend them. Will NATO escalate its war on Russia? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Glenn Deason in Oslo. He's a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the book, Russophobia, Propaganda in International Politics. And here in Moscow, we have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst and editor at InnoSME Internet Media Project. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's start out with Glenn in Oslo. We have, as we speak right now, there's a number of referendums being held in Ukraine. Very significant here. Of course, it's completely rejected in the West. I don't want to waste our time on that. They always reject a referenda they don't like, okay? But we've been following the military operation, but now the political dimension is coming into play. So please explain to our viewers the importance of these votes. Go ahead.
The importance is that so far, when Russia went into Ukraine, it was defined as a special military operation, and it was supposed to then liberate, as Russia says, the Donbas from Ukraine. However, as the war drags on, obviously. The resources put into this, the cost increase on Russia as well, the stakes will increase as well. So by Russia recognizing these four territories, that's Lugansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporozhye as part of Russia, it has huge implications. For one, Russia will have to devote a lot more troops to defend its own soil. Again, I know many people will say, critical, especially in the West, well, it's not really Russia, it's Ukraine. Well, if Russia is recognized as Russia, from the Russian legal standpoint, it is Russia. And so it will devote more troops to defend its territory, which then requires a partial mobilization. And also, it will defend these territories at all costs. That is, this is considered to be an intrinsic part of the Russian Federation. And as we know as well, the Russian nuclear doctrine allows for the use of nuclear weapons in two instances. One, if it's attacked by nuclear weapons, but also if the existence of the state is threatened. Now, one can argue that the existence of Russia was threatened by merely having NATO in Ukraine, but obviously from putting its own territories on the line, this increases the likelihood of that reasoning for using nuclear weapons would be used. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think that Russia would want to go in this direction, but it's obviously a huge, it's part of the escalation. It's now raising the bar. And as you just pointed out, the interesting part is how will the West react? Because we have to keep in mind, after this Kharkov offensive, which was, it's complicated, but obviously it can be defined as a great success in terms of claiming territory for the Ukrainians. And in the West, we kind of, popped the champagne bottles, almost declaring victory in the war. And suddenly, to go from that until these four territories becoming part of Russia and Russia raising the bar, it begs the question, how will the West respond? It puts it in that dilemma. On one hand,
how they respond militarily, okay? Obviously, they're not going to recognize it as a political fact.
The military response, yeah.
Right. Let me go to Dima here now. Basically, the same question to you, Dima, because it's when they talk about a negotiated end to the conflict, once these referendums are completed, and I think it's fair to say that they will pass, they will make a request to the Russian Federation to join Russia. I think we can assume that's going to happen. So there's a different, if there's going to be a negotiated end, it's going to be a different Ukraine that'll be negotiating. Dima.
Well, I think there are two points of view, two positions from which you can view this situation. One is most important for me, and that is a purely human viewpoint, right? people living in these territories, these are 8 million people. What do they feel? What do they fear? You know, I have friends there, I have relatives, and they're all saying the same thing. We don't want the front line to move. If Russia can assure that we are secure, let us be part of Russia. Just don't go away, you know, don't let the Ukrainian troops come back. If you allow the Ukrainian troops to come back, then you are to blame for something terrible. Then you should not have started this, because you make us suffer. You know, either do it to the end or don't start doing that. Okay. Yep. The same story was in Chechnya. I don't have relatives in Chechnya, but I remember that that was exactly the mood of the population there during the Second War, you know, when the Islamists were finally evicted from Chechnya. So basically, the Western position is very politicized. Actually, I can sum it up like this. They don't want peace in Ukraine. They want a defeat of Russia. You know, look how the Western media covered this so-called Ukrainian counteroffensive in Kharkiv. So many square miles of Russian territory have been regained. You know, they don't speak about thousands of Ukrainian and sometimes Russian soldiers killed. They don't talk about the suffering of the population in Izium, which was under Ukrainian control. Then Russians came in, then Ukrainians came back and started arresting and torturing people who collaborated with Russians. So the Western attitude is very politicized. They don't feel pity for the people. And from this point of view, I think everything on the side of the West is very irresponsible. Basically, they're asking themselves the question, is Putin bluffing when he said that Russia would use all the means necessary? I like the position of an Italian expert, Fabio Mini, who basically said, this is irresponsible to check if someone is bluffing in this situation. The stakes are too high. You want to try it again, like you tried it in Syria, you tried it in Iraq, you tried it in Afghanistan. You want to give it a try? This may be your last try. So not only yours, but for the whole of humanity. So the position of the West, which is united in idiocy, like again, you know, the Italian side, Antidiplomatico, writes that this is the first time since 19th century when all European press is united in covering a certain conflict. All the media, except a few independent voices, is on one side. And they're like racing, who is going to insult Russia more? Who is going to suggest something more terrible? And this is a very dangerous situation, because indeed the situation on the ground, on the battleground, is volatile. I agree with Glenn. I'm sure that ultimately Russia, of course, has huge superiority, a lot more resources. But Russia did not want territorial gains. So look at the actions of the Russian government since 1991. We were invited by the Kyrgyz government in 2010 when they had riots in Osh. A Russian army was invited. And we didn't go in there, even though we were invited. Why? Because we don't want territorial gains. We were not ready to take responsibility.
Well, it's not about territorial gains. It's about the will of the people on the ground. Let me switch back to
Glenn. Security. Yeah,
exactly here. And so this is what is in play here. It's already been said. Putin said himself that this is not a bluff. Okay. Do you think the West takes that seriously? Because, I mean, you can't be more emphatic than saying it right out loud. Glenn.
Well, I think that's a very important question, because this so-called questioning whether or not this is a nuclear bluff on behalf of Russia. I think the reason behind the questioning it at all is because the West and Russia, they, from my perspective, they appear to escalate differently. If you see the way the West escalates, it tends to embrace this, you know, salami tactics. It takes very slow, thin slices gradually, and this is how it's escalated, while Russia tends to take this, you know, hold on and take this big leaps, if you will. So, for example, if you only take it from the 2014, after the West supported toppling Yanukovych, President Yanukovych in Kyiv, then we saw, you know, again, Russia took a big step. It took back Crimea and also supported Donbass, but then we saw NATO play this incremental, gradual escalation in which they, you know, refused to implement Minsk. They didn't. They didn't say it openly. They just didn't push Kyiv to do anything. And also, they kind of in their language, they played it down like it's the spirit of it. And at the same time, they were pumping in gradually more and more weapons. Slowly supporting, shutting down opposition media, shutting down opposition political parties, you know, arresting the opposition leader, gradually suppressing Russian language and culture, you know, we're building up troops in Donbass. You know, there was a very gradual escalation. And then suddenly we see Russia again, warning, don't do this, otherwise we will escalate. But instead of having a small escalation, then you have, you know, Russia recognizing Donbass and then invading. And then we see the West as well, doing the same thing gradually. So slowly more and more heavier and heavier weapons. In the beginning, remember, they didn't even want to send fighter planes. Now everything is on the table. So this gradual escalation. And then, of course, we take it for granted now, but they've been, you know, the Americans took credit for helping sink the Moscow warship, you know, killing off Russian military leaders. You know, the Kharkov offensive, the Americans suggest this was almost directed by them and the British. So now you gradually up to this NATO-Russian war. And again, it's Russia's time to escalate. It's not gradual. It does this huge escalation where it now partially mobilizes 300,000 troops, has a referendum in these four regions and set this nuclear threat out. So I think part of the reason why we don't take the bluff seriously enough in the West, the statement in the West seriously, why we think it might be a bluff, is because it seems like a very big step that we're kind of expecting this slow incremental escalation. But I think it's to some extent we're escalating somewhat differently. And
let me go to Dima before we go to the break here. I mean, this is all part of a process, Dima, and it goes back to Istanbul in the early part of the conflict, where there was some kind of deal there, and it was the West that rejected. This is what we're told here. And so, you know, that gives a reason to continue the escalation, because if one side is offered a negotiated end and it's not interested in, you have to escalate. You have no other choice. Dima, 30 seconds before we go to the break.
Well, yes, that's what our foreign minister said, that the West basically prohibited the Ukrainian side to look for a compromise after the Istanbul meeting. And there is a fact, you know, the Ukrainian side stopped negotiation then. And now Mr. Zelensky is saying we're not interested in further negotiation. Until we win, we're not going to negotiate.
Okay, Dima, hold that thought. We're going to go to a quick break. And after that quick break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Let's go back to Dima in Moscow. Right before we went to the break, you were trying to finish your point. Go right ahead, my friend.
Well, basically, this is the problem. Who wants negotiations? Obviously, Russia wants negotiations because this is a terrible conflict. People are suffering. You know, we don't want Ukrainians and Russians to die. Until recently, we never made a difference between Russians and Ukrainians. I think Putin was very sincere when he said that it was the same people. It was the Ukrainian side that stopped negotiation. It was the West that banished Russia from all international institutions, from international dialogue. You know, we barely managed to have our foreign minister attend the United Nations General Assembly. So Russia had a choice. Putin had a choice to make. Rules-based order, or in general, you know, international law, or security of the people, 8 million people living in eastern Ukraine. And because we were treated so dishonestly, because obviously international law is not for us, it's for someone else. This decision was taken to ensure the security. There's a very important fact that is overlooked in the West, why people are in fact voting there. I mean, I'm looking at the police reports from Ukraine, right? At least 25 local officials were assassinated on the territories controlled by Russia. Russia since February 24. The Ukrainian side does not comment. Maybe it was all just, you know, criminal problems. No, of course, these were assassination teams sent by Kyiv, and people died in car bomb attacks. People were shot. You know, the prosecutor general of Luhansk region, the woman who headed the electoral commission. Now the Ukrainian side is deliberately targeting the voting booths where people are voting at this referendum. So when you have this kind of attitude,
If the state that Kyiv will maintain its claim of legitimacy there, it's killing its own citizens. Okay, this is I can't think of another reason to vote to leave.
Exactly. I mean, this is awful. I mean, it was the same story as with Chechnya and Beslan. You know, until these school children were taken as hostages by people who claim to be Maskhadov supporters, who claim to support Chechnya's independence. You could talk about it, but they committed such a huge crime that any talk about Chechnya's secession from Russia stopped, at least for more or less moral people at that moment in 2004, when children were taken as hostages. In the same way now, if you don't like this referendum so much, if you consider it a fake, why are you bombing people voting? Why are you launching HIMARS missiles, precisely hitting, you know, the places where people work, where people vote, or where local administration works? You know, in Kherson, HIMARS missiles hit the administration in Kherson, precisely targeting, you know, Mr. Stremousov, the head of the administration there. So, I mean, with this kind of attitude, how can we talk about international law? What kind of rules is this world order going to be based on? So basically, we're living an empty shell. You know, when the West says, oh, Russia is leaving the legal framework. Yes, because you made the legal framework an empty shell.
Yeah, and Glenn, you know, I've kind of had a sea change over the last few weeks in thinking about the timing or the duration of this conflict, because I think everyone on the Russian side, at least, wanted to see this wrapped up as soon as possible, saving lives, obviously. But considering Russia is facing the entire industrialized West, I mean, I call it NATO world, okay? So this is, Russia is at war with NATO in Ukraine. But the question of timing is really important, because the longer the conflict goes on, the suffering, of course, continues, but the unraveling of the so-called unity and solidarity of the West is becoming more and more apparent, because as time passes, the real pain, not the sanctions against Russia, but the sanctioners are the ones that are feeling the pain as it gets cooler and cooler with every passing day. Your thoughts, Glenn?
Well, this is why we have these escalations to begin with, because we are in a position now of almost not total war, but exhausting completely the other side, and essentially claiming full victory. That's why there's also no room for diplomacy anymore. That's why this conflict is so frightening. Now, well, you know, one could say that one can therefore see how this has escalated over the past 6 months. Because when the war began, keep in mind that Russia, you know, stormed up to Kyiv in the capital, and they put a lot of pressure on Zelensky to accept what they couldn't get before 24th of February, which was a final settlement on this conflict. And as Dima correctly pointed out, there's a lot of reports from both Ukraine and America that this is when Boris Johnson came to Kyiv and said, listen, don't make any deals with the Russians. We can instead exhaust them. We can bleed them dry, effectively. Let's not deal with them. And this is also something that Boris Johnson said later on, like we should avoid any bad peace with Russia. We should dictate the peace, which means we have to defeat the Russians, which is what the EU, the Americans, to some extent have said, that they have to be defeated on the battlefield. And this is the problem. Now you enter a war of exhausting the opponent, and this is why it also implies a lot of escalation, because before then, keep in mind, Russia had avoided a lot of civilian infrastructure. It didn't even attack a lot of the barracks where it knew that Ukrainian soldiers were. Its main message was, you know, we're not in conflict with you, we're in conflict with the Zelensky government. So gradually this continues to increase. NATO pushing more and more weapons. Russia escalates on this side, and you have this mutual escalation going on. And because if the goal is to exhaust the enemy, and there's no diplomacy, and I mean there's no diplomacy anymore on the table, then if it's only full victory, this is when you have this mutual escalation. So I think that about the timing, that this is probably something that the Kremlin is calculating, because if you look at weapon storages across NATO, I mean, they say that across Eastern Europe, the Soviet weapons are gone. The Germans say we hardly have anything left. I've heard reports in America, not only that there a lot of the storage, weapon storages have been depleted, but they're taking weapons out of active service to ship to Ukraine. Again, I haven't been able to see in these reports verified, but you, undoubtedly the weapons have been exhausted, and also the European economies. I mean, things aren't going great in Europe now. It's difficult to heat the homes. Industries can't obviously survive. A lot of the energy-intensive industries can't survive. So, and again, that's Russia exhausting us. And then, of course, we are trying to exhaust the Russians by, as Boris Johnson suggested, we have to bleed the Russians dry slowly. This is also something Rand Corporation, by the way, has advocated for many years, that escalating the conflict in Donbass, they had a long report on this in 2019. This could help to get Russia more involved in the region, bleed out more Russians in terms of both blood and reserves. And this is a way of destroying Russia. So we are, to some extent, in an existential conflict. I mean,
that's the word, existential.
So this is why I have this crazy escalation on both sides and no diplomacy. And this is why it's a very frightening situation.
Dima, I want to go back to the referendums. I think it's very important to point out to our viewers that this will have a demonstration effect. We have four regions that are voting on leaving Ukraine and obviously joining Russia. And then we have the military campaign. So we can add like Odessa, Kharkov eventually. Because once this process of leaving Ukraine, joining Russia, it will set as a precedent for other regions of Ukraine. And it'd be obviously ultimately most important that the Russians are there to protect the people that they recognize as being part of the country. What kind of demonstration effect will it have?
Well, let me first explain something to our Western viewers. Ukraine was a democracy until 2014. And when Ukraine was a democracy, these regions, Kharkov, Kharkov is not voting, but Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson, they always voted for the so-called pro-Russian candidate. They voted for Kuchma against Kravchuk. They voted for Yanukovych against Yushchenko. Then they voted for Yanukovych against Tymoshenko. They always supported the pro-Russian, as they say, the Eastern candidate. So basically, since 2014, these people had no choice. They could not elect their people into government. They were barred from doing that. And the West then started calling Ukraine a democracy, which was very strange. But I agree with Glenn completely. This idea to bleed out Russia, it reminds me of the German and French strategy during the First World War, which was catastrophic. In Verdun, you know, the Germans wanted to ausbluten, you know, to bleed out the French army. The result was that they bled out themselves, you know, each other, and the First World War became the tragedy that we know. So in the same way, I mean, this is the pattern with the West now. There is a small conflict. The West gets in, you know. Okay, in Syria, there were a few children painting something bad about Mr. Assad. The West moved in, you know, making it a huge problem, you know, basically inviting fighters from other countries who came to Syria, and it became a huge civil war, which continued until recently. In the same way, if Russia had its way, Ukraine would have an election in 2014, maybe in the beginning of 2015. Mr. Yanukovych would get reelected, or he would get thrown out of the presidential palace by legal means, and everything would be fine. But the West wanted a revolution. They wanted a change of government. In the same way now, I mean, I'm watching the German television ARD, They're happy about this partial mobilization of Russia. Why? They're writing this. Putin is under pressure. Putin is unter Druck. It doesn't matter for them, you know, that people are dying, that Ukraine is suffering. What matters is that Putin is under pressure. And what is interesting, they are writing on their side that Putin is under pressure not only from the anti-war liberal movement, but also from the ultra-nationalists. How can it be, if we are in such an authoritarian government, that there are people, you know, who put the president under pressure? There is a part of public opinion. You can't have it in a totalitarian or an authoritarian system. We have it. Why? I can explain to you. Because Russia has not been an authoritarian state since 1987, at least.
Okay, Dima, we have to end on this point here. Fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Oslo and in Moscow. I want to thank our viewer for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.